Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Exits Closed. I'm Cynthia Pooler. I'm starting a new segment on this show. It's called Pandemic Talk with Lainey Bond. So, Lainey, the last time we spoke, what can you say? What's been happening since then?
You know, Cynthia, every single day there is so much new stuff coming out about COVID. There is so much research, so much progress being made. And as you probably know, the vaccine seems to be the headline today. The difference, there's been some dispute and some questions about the vaccine. People are concerned because it's a different type of delivery than they've been familiar with in the past. So this is the COVID-19 or coronavirus vaccine that is going to be the key to breaking the cycle in this pandemic and getting it under control. Previously, you know, it was well known that vaccines were delivered in two manners. One would be attenuated or a weakened virus where you're getting a piece of the live virus that's been broken down chemically by scientists and what they call attenuated, and it gets you a little bit sick. That had its risks with it is immune compromise, who may get really sick from just a little bit of the live virus. The other method that's been traditionally known is the dead virus. So that's where the actual virus has been killed and put into a vaccine by scientists and injected into people. And that is sometimes less risky as far as people getting infections, but it's also less effective than an attenuated vaccine. So now we're into the new phase, the 20th century. We've had all these remarkable scientific and technological advances, and we've got things like cloning that we've been doing for about 20 years, to my knowledge, and that's a rough number. There's been a lot of news over the last, you know, two decades also about harvesting T cells from umbilical cords of fetuses. So this new approach to giving a vaccine is an RNA splice. So you've all heard of DNA, but an RNA is a building block to DNA. So we all have RNA in our bodies. And the vaccine that is coming out for COVID-19 is an RNA based vaccine. So what does that mean? There's been some rumors about fetal cells from aborted babies being put into this, or they've been identified as stolen babies, they've been identified as sold babies, and I want to just dispel that rumor right now. What they have done, three manufacturers have done, and only three, there's about 15, or there might be 10, but only three manufacturers have actually used any sort of a human RNA factor in their manufacturing of their vaccine, and those RNA factors are being taken from donated umbilical cords of healthy women that have been carefully screened for genetic and health issues, and they have donated the umbilical cord to science after the baby has been born. Do you have any questions on that, Cynthia?
You know, you're saying after the baby has been born, so anybody at this point who just delivered a baby, they can be a donor?
Yeah, it depends on the screening criteria and the affiliations the doctor or hospital have with research facilities. So, you know, they're going to be eliminating things like mothers with MS or people with, you know, bleeding disorders, or some, I would imagine, and this isn't factual, I'm just imagining they would screen out things like chemical dependency because, you know, those are all rooted in some genetic factors. So they have screened the donor mothers for genetics and for health risks. and they have selected a very few who met the criteria and passed all of those tests.
Okay. So when do you think that'll be available?
The vaccine was delivered to 25 states about 2 days ago, and there's more scheduled. I don't have the schedule for the deliveries, but the vaccines have started in hospitals to frontline workers. A lot of nurses have received it already. Mm-hmm. Team is being given in two phases. So you get one shot, and then about 3 weeks later, you get your second shot. And then about 2 weeks after that, they feel like you're more protected with immunity because you have built antibodies. So when you get your injection, everybody should be aware that you are going to get a little bit sick. So this is RNA. It is a piece of the virus spliced into a gene, whether it's a human gene, a monkey gene, a gerbil gene, which they have, you know, used this to basically, I think you could use the word clone. They replicate it, grow it in test tubes. They need a very little to start this. But you are receiving a bit of the live virus. And so, therefore, you get a little bit sick with it. You get some symptoms like nausea. You get some cold symptoms. You might be achy and have a low-grade fever for a few days. Most nurses mm-hmm. who've gotten it so far are reporting 2 to 3 days of just feeling a little bit crappy. But the point is that you go into this with the expectation you are going to have some symptoms, but you are not going to have the full-blown illness that is going to require you to be hospitalized and put on a ventilator and put your life at risk.
Now, I've got a question for you, and I don't know if you might have the answer or not. You know, the shots for this has been really quick, but
mm-hmm.
but with AIDS, you know, it was first detected like in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
and that's like years ago, and there's still no vaccine for that. Why do you think there's no vaccine for AIDS? Well, there's the vaccine for COVID-19.
Well, I can give you an answer for that. There are different okay. types of viruses, and some are easier to kill than others. And AIDS happens to be the most difficult kind to kill. And it replicates so quickly that if you are not able to get treated after an exposure, your first treatment within 2 hours, it's already replicated and doubled. And then every 2 hours, that virus doubles. So you can get a pretty high viral load within just 24 hours. So it has a waxy substance around it. It's very hard for medication to penetrate, and it's also very hard to create a vaccine that will prevent that. So the SARS viruses are a little bit easier to treat and to identify and break their cycle, interrupt their RNA replication, which interrupts their DNA replication. And I'm not sure about their replication cycle, you know, how fast it happens, but I think mm-hmm. that nothing really compares to the AIDS virus as far as those challenges.
So you have a number of Facebook groups, and you have a COVID-19 Facebook group. Have you gotten mm-hmm. a lot more people on that group?
Sure. We're up to 5,100 people in the COVID nurses professional discussion page. I have been really focused on establishing the nonprofit and working on getting the services together for nurses in crisis. So I haven't been doing a lot of focus on growing that group at the moment. I have another mm-hmm. group that's growing exponentially, organically. It's up to over almost 800 members now. It's COVID-19 Long Hauler Support Group. I've even got an HBO producer looking for athletes who are suffering long haul symptoms so they can be featured in a documentary.
Well, you know, the phrase long haul, is that's been used for a couple of months now, I believe. So people who contracted COVID-19, like in, you know, late winter, early spring last year, and they still see symptoms, they're going to have that for a long time, right?
Yeah, it's not exactly symptoms. So what they're having are sequelae. So symptoms would kind of refer, at least in my mind, to an active infection. You know, you're still contagious, you're still in that recovery period. But these people who've gone on for longer than a month, you're typically not contagious after 10 days with COVID. If you have immunocompromised, you can be contagious up to 20 days. There are some outliers where people have been found to be contagious with live active viral load for a month or more, but it's extremely rare, and they usually have other health factors. So the long haulers are still in the recovery phase, but not the active infection stage. So this infection can cause inflammation. It causes inflammation in the brain. It causes inflammation in the central nervous system, other organs like the lungs and the heart, and the liver. So even the pancreas has been involved in some cases. So it's inflammation. It's kind of like when you break your leg and it heals, but it's still painful for a year. This inflammation is that pain after a broken leg. So the problem I am seeing, though, with infection in long haulers is that the antibodies they built are not necessarily protecting them just 6 months later. So we're not confident that this is a virus you get once and then you never get again, like chicken pox. It's more like a cold that can mutate and reinfect you pretty quickly. So I've seen reports of people getting reinfected as early as 6 weeks. That's, again, on the rare side. But it seems like 3 months is a pretty big target, 3 to 6 months. I've got some long haulers who are saying all of a sudden they feel feverish and they're testing positive again. That means they've been reinfected. One young woman I was speaking to, you know, she's a PhD candidate, very highly educated woman. She has been very specific about being isolated and not having contact. She has gone to the grocery store when she's needed to, but no socializing, no drinking in bars, no eating in restaurants. And she just tested positive again in December when she was positive back in March. So I wonder if her immunity, you know, her immune system is just weakened still and made her more vulnerable to the slightest bit of exposure.
You know, I'm aware of the fact that this virus mutates quickly. So when somebody gets the vaccine and there's a new strain of it, a new strain of a mutated virus, then the vaccination that they got will not be good for this new mutated strain, right?
Well, you know, we don't have enough data to prove or disprove that statement right now. But if we don't have a vaccine, there is not going to be an end to this, right? So we have to get it under control somehow. And with any vaccine, what you're going to see with anything that mutates, like the flu and such, you're going to see the scientists making their best guess as to where those mutations are going to occur and how they're going to design the vaccine for the coming year. So there are risks. There are so many questions. But what we do know for certain is if we don't start getting people immune to this or less vulnerable to this, we are going to suffer dire consequences. I mean, we already have suffered dire consequences. If I can add something else about the vaccine and the new technology with the RNA, one of the pieces is that there's a lot of fear around this vaccine because people feel like it was rushed. So I have a few things to talk about on that. One of the pieces of this is that the pharmaceutical companies that are all interested in making money, I mean, a pharmaceutical company is in the business simply to make money. And people are worried that they've rushed and put out stuff that's going to hurt them or make them sick or kill them. And I just want to assure you that it's my belief that no pharmaceutical company is going to risk billions of dollars of revenue to put out something that's going to harm people. I see a lot of rumors about the different things that this can cause, infertility, DNA changes in your body, faking your body into thinking it's pregnant all the time. And with the trace amounts of RNA that are being used for this, it just doesn't seem scientifically possible. Of course, long-term studies are going to be needed to prove that. But I feel like there's such a factor of misinformation and drama and people giving out their ideas and their hypotheses without having a scientific basis or research to back it up is really gaining a lot of traction. And we're already so hypersensitive around this whole issue. And, you know, even in the wake of the election and the drama around that, that this has been so politicized. But I really don't think that this is going to be as risky or these crazy ideas that people are putting out there, even like the gene tagging that's going to be, what are they saying, like an identifier is going to be injected with the medication. I don't see scientifically how that could even possibly happen. Our bodies would migrate that. It would end up in our kidneys or our bowels and be excreted sooner or later. So that idea is not—it's not the same as implanting a chip in your dog's neck. The other thing I want to say is the technology is relatively new compared to the history of vaccines with the attenuated and the dead vaccines, but this technology is not brand new. So it's been around for about 10 years. Some of the flu vaccines have already been using this RNA splicing approach, and it's been very successful without any of these awful sequelae or complications that I'm seeing all this gossip and rumor about. The other factor with the speed of how quickly the vaccine has come about is that we have been in an unprecedented emergency worldwide. The word pandemic means worldwide. This isn't an epidemic in the U.S. or Africa or one country. It's a pandemic, and this has the potential to damage all citizens around the world. So I think in recognition of that, and I'd like to actually, you know, give kudos to these pharmaceutical companies that actually have for the first time joined together and partnered to develop this thing quickly. So normally you have everybody operating in their own tower. They've got their own research. They're not sharing it. They're not publicizing it. It's a race to get to the finish line first so you can make the most money. But in this unprecedented effort, a ton of these pharmaceutical companies have joined resources. This is a worldwide effort, a multi-pharmaceutical company effort, where they have shared resources, shared their technology, shared their information, and pooled it all together to get this vaccine developed with an approach and a medium that they've been using for 10 years and get this RNA splicing that's specific to COVID-19 into this and then get it distributed. I don't know if people even understand how much goes into the supply chain, but if you think about starting from the beginning, just how to identify a virus, how to start identifying the way we're going to disarm that virus, and then how do you get that mass produced? I mean, how many people are there? How many millions of people are there in the world? Just our country alone has millions and millions of people. So how do you make a vial or two vials in this situation for every person in the world? And how do you get that from the factory to the distributors than to the doctors and the pharmacies and the other people and agencies that are administering the vaccine? And then how do you get all the people in the world into those locations to actually receive their vaccines? This is an immense undertaking. It has never been done before. It has never been seen before, and it's never been necessary before in a way like since the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. So we are very lucky to be living in this time of technology and research and computers and immediate communications and cell phones to be able to protect the world within less than 2 years. When I was in nursing school and I was studying epidemiology, pandemics were recorded, and we were taught that this is going to be a two-year cycle. And we may be effectively shutting that down in less than 2 years. It's still going to take, I think, 2 years to get it remediated and more controlled. But we were so effective, at least in the U.S., at flattening the curve in March. And the importance of those efforts is that it gave scientists and manufacturers and the supply chain, you know, participants the time to get this stuff together. This second surge was completely anticipated by epidemiologists worldwide. It was anticipated to start on November 5th and last through February 5th. And we are in such a great position to be receiving the vaccines now in this peak, when we can actually protect some of the healthcare workers that are being exposed. We need to take care of these people because of their skills that really can't be replicated and easily replaced if they're sick or dying. We're able to protect our elderly who are more vulnerable physically. And then I think the children will probably be next, because children in their growth spurts are so vulnerable to illness and other immunocompromised issues, just because all their energy is going into building those bones and growing their bodies. And then I think the general public. But I don't have any information on when this will be completed, but I do know that they are growing this vaccine medium at record speeds. They can easily do it and replicate it in a lab setting and test tubes, and then get that distributed into the vaccine. And thankfully, the supply chain with delivery trucks and everything, we've been able to pivot and actually make this happen. And it's going to have some bumps. It's already had some bumps over the last year. There's so much to learn. But the bottom line is we are doing it, and we are successful. And that is not just the U.S. It's worldwide.
So, you know, it was just a year ago that COVID-19 became known and people became aware of it. And there's been all kinds of theories on how this happened. How do you think COVID-19 originated?
I have some thoughts, but I really don't want to speak publicly about them. I feel like this possibly did escape from that lab in Wuhan. Whether that was intentional or accidental, I think that it's really important for the world to understand how viruses work and to do this research. I mean, this is what's gotten us to this vaccine, right? But there was clearly a break in the controlled setting where some of this escaped. And it to me, I don't know if it was intentional or not intentional, but it's just accidental that this started out close to a lab that was located in the same city this started in.
Okay, so there's medical workers across the country that are every day they're going to hospitals, they're helping people. They're helping sick people, they're helping dying people. What percentage of the medical community has contracted COVID, from your estimation?
Boy, I wish I had a number. It doesn't seem like any of our tracking, our national or international tracking programs are identifying healthcare workers or nurses. So the percentage, I can't even gander, but I would majority at this point have had either a mild case or are now sick. I've got 5,000 members in my group. This long haulers group is climbing up towards 1,000. And people have had some sniffles and such that they think were COVID, but, you know, we couldn't test early on. So that data's there. There's some politics involved in this as far as, you know, a hospital or a nursing home not wanting to release that data because then who wants to work there? You know, there's mm-hmm. so many factors into why this isn't being reported. We also weren't ready to report it. We don't have a national database of nurses that we can go to and say, hey, I've got COVID and give us a number, although that's a really good idea. Maybe I'll start that too. We weren't prepared, just like we weren't necessarily prepared to handle this with the lack of PPE planning. We weren't prepared to track a specific profession as far as active cases or people who develop the virus. There will mm-hmm. this year be some data like the Work Comp Research Institute. They will have some data that I'm sure they will analyze and put out some articles on as far as how many COVID claims were submitted for workers' comp. So that might give us an indicator. But what we also know, and it's unfortunate, but there are a lot of employers, including hospitals, who are denying workers' comp claims for COVID. They are saying you can't prove you got it at work, you've been out to the grocery store. And, you know, when you look at it from the big picture, of course they're right. But to me, when you look at it from the point that the nurses are dealing with the sickest of the sick people, they are doing CPR on them, they have them on a ventilator, that means that the virus is aerosolized in their atmosphere and they don't have properly fitting PPE that's protecting them. I think that it's really a no-brainer that these ICU nurses, critical care nurses, hospital nurses, long-term care nurses, and other associated workers, you know, housekeepers, home health aides, the CNAs at the hospitals, these people have a higher viral load exposure for, I would say, that is work-related or an industrial illness.
Hey, Lonnie, our time is up. So real quick, can you give your contact information, what Facebook groups you created?
Sure. So the one Facebook group for the community that's people coming to find information so they're not feeling so isolated is COVID-19 Long Hauler Support, and it's got a blue picture with a stethoscope on it as far as the profile. My other nurse is a professional discussion board. You're welcome to join, especially if you are a professional healthcare worker. That is COVID-19, all one word with no dash, nurses. And that mm-hmm. is a teal kind of picture of a nurse looking out the window for the profile picture. And then we've also started a nonprofit, nurseadvocacynetwork.org. And if you are a healthcare worker in crisis or needing information, if you are a donor or somebody who's willing to volunteer some of your services, you can email us at savinglives@nurseadvocacynetwork.org. That's savinglives@nurseadvocacynetwork.org.
Hey, Lainey, thank you so much. We will talk again. You've been listening to Lainey Bond. I'm Cynthia Pooler. This is All Exits Closed, and if you like this show, follow us on Twitter. Thank you. Have a great day. Thanks, Lainey, for being on the show.
Thank you, Cynthia. Take care.